Hi, and welcome to Ohio Martial Arts Mind Power. This is episode one of my two-part interview with Sensei Charles Reed Miller of Summit Martial Arts in Delaware, Ohio. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Sensei Reed Miller. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear me all right?
Loud and clear. Sounds crystal clear, as a matter of fact. So that's a good thing. Great. Well, welcome. I'm super glad that you're here. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us today. And I'm kind of overdue. I told this to Coach Bundy a couple weeks ago when I was talking to him. And the thing I told him was that, you know, I've known him for many, many years, but a lot of these questions I'm going to be asking you today, I have no idea the answer to. It's kind of fun for me to get to know people in a way that, you know, we talk about the industry, we talk about our field, we talk about practice, but, you know, we don't really talk about our pasts and stuff. And all the time that I've known you, you know, there's so many names, particularly from our martial arts heritage, because those roots kind of run cross current with each other. And
yes, sir.
You'll bring up a name and I'll know who that person is, and I'll bring up a name and you'll know who that person is. And so it's that's why our friendship has been so strong over the years.
Well, we're kind of in the first family tree of American martial arts. So I think a lot of people kind of share some of the heritage that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So for those of you that don't know, Sensei Reed Miller directs Summit Martial Arts, and he's in Delaware, Ohio. And Sensei, if you could just kind of go back in time and tell us just a little bit about your, you know, how did you get started in martial arts? When did you get started? What was your history like?
Well, we had moved to Delaware from a small town, Richwood, Ohio, just a very small farm town. My dad was an AMP manager, for those that remember that store. And I was kind of the typical athlete, and I had been on a kind of a losing football team, and I didn't enjoy the experience of losing. So I decided I wanted to pursue things that were up to me. And so I went into karate in 1975. I was 13, and I kind of figured my parents would fight me on it, but my dad actually found my instructor, or knew of him, Sensei Don Robinson, rest his soul, became my first teacher. He, very tough, hard sensei. I wouldn't call it Cobra Kai, but it had elements of that. You know what I mean? It was, in those days, it was kind of, well, let's see if you've got what it takes. They didn't kind of help you along, really. You know, if you were kind of a quitter, they wanted you to quit and get the heck out of there, quote, not waste their time. And my parents supported it completely, because I was kind of a, I guess what you call a hyperactive type kid, very go, go, go. You know, school was challenging for me. I didn't mind it so much, but it was never something I loved. And as soon as I started getting into karate, they were very quick. If you want to be good at karate, you need to do judo too. And I'm like, what? Wait, what? Yeah. And I ended up starting judo that same year at 13. At a college I teach at now, Ohio Wesleyan, they had a very competitive college program, and so that's kind of where the adventure started. And before that, you know, I would drive my dad crazy with we had what was called a Kung Fu theater every Saturday on TV. He hated it, I loved it. And Kwai Cheng Kang, the Kung Fu guy, you know, was a series that I never missed. And so I was kind of hooked early from a fascination aspect. Yeah. Not quite sure why now, because some of that stuff seems so hokey looking back. But, you know, my generation, we didn't have you know, 200 channels. We didn't have the ability to record things. There was no internet. So, you know, it was kind of bigger than life at the time, you know? So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and, you know, those guys that trained back in the 1970s, you know, it was just such a different era. So there was a little bit of, you know, and I think probably it's true of maybe the Gracie family might be another example. When you're trying to introduce something new, there's just a matter of does it work or doesn't it work?
Yeah.
And you had to be a pretty tough person just to teach martial arts, because it was not something that everybody's very proud of, but somebody didn't think you knew what you were doing, they would call you out on it.
Oh yeah, the 70s were a rough time, and we had not just new people, but we would have so-called black belts come in and you know, challenge people, and many times the students would end up, well, spar with him first. And, you know, and I think the instructor was kind of watching what, you know, what the guy did. And then if you did beat the student, God help the guy, because the sensei would figure out everything he knew. And, you know, I've heard Gracie's do the same thing. Well, he'll be right with you. Go ahead and spar with him. He'll be right with you. Go ahead and spar with this one. So you go through half a dozen people and okay, he's ready for you now. So they were not only tough, they were calculated, sneaky. That's the biggest thing I remember. When I first started, I don't know how old you were, but they gave me like a size 5 gi and, you know, have your mom hem that down. They didn't have any kids sizes. You know, it was a very powerful message to me. It's like, oh, I've got to wear an adult size uniform. There's no such thing as a kid uniform.
And, right.
And the guys would take the blunt back then. We had some girls in class, but, you know, they weren't nearly as hard on the girls. But my first black eye came from a girl, Connie. I was kind of looking at my instructor like, what am I supposed to do with her? And she punched me right in the eye and like, fight, boy. And then I can remember I had a black eye and I thought, how am I going to hide this? I almost borrowed my mother's makeup case or something to hide it. And I got to the high school. I think I was a freshman or something. And she was watching for me to get there. And she walked me through the hall, showed everybody she knew and probably everyone I knew. I gave him that black eye. So I didn't talk about my karate much during my high school day. I kept it very private because I didn't quite know what was going to happen on day two.
Right.
The worst part is the next time I went to class, another girl was there and I didn't really know her and I had not seen her before. And I was going to spar her. And I'm like, well, this ain't happening again. And I hit her with a sidekick. And turned out she had a bad leg. She flew backwards into a bunch of chairs and everything else. And of course, every black belt in the room, including my sensei, like gave me these horrible stares. Like, what is your problem? Why would you do that to that poor girl? I'm like, oh my God. And, you know, things like duck walks and knuckle push-ups were lesson building opportunities, I guess.
Back in those days. you had touched on something a little bit earlier where you had talked about, you know, how the model was, because that's certainly the way it was for me when I started. The model was, look, you know, you signed up in this program. Now it's our job to get you to quit.
Yeah.
And if you don't quit, then you earn a seat at the table. But if you quit, then we just serve everybody a purpose. Now, that's not the way to teach. In fact, that's a terrible thing. But you know, we have to understand that a lot of the people that were first introducing martial arts into the United States were military people.
Yeah.
And they had sort of a militaristic thing. And it sounds really brutal if you've never experienced it, but there were certain individuals, I have to tell you, I was one of them. There were certain individuals that benefited from that environment.
Yeah, I did too.
That environment. For me, you know, it was just to jump in here real quick. It was a real tough thing to go and really struggle in other areas because of poverty and other family situations.
Yeah.
And then to go in an environment where they said, we're going to make this so hard that nobody's going to stay with it. And yet I was able to stay with it when many of the other people that were successful in other areas couldn't keep up. And that, do we want that? No. Are we great teachers today? Yes.
You know, though, I wouldn't trade it. I don't think kids nowadays were ready where, you know, my parents were very popular. You know, I'm not raising a boy, I'm raising a man. And, you know, I had to start working early. In fact, that same year, I moved in with my Uncle Hope, who had a roofing company. And, you know, of course, from a 13-year-old, I'm thinking I'm going to be building houses and doing all kinds of cool stuff. All I did all day long was carry roofing shingles up and then clean up the mess. You know, the first day of work, and the next day I couldn't move. He had to roll me out of bed and I had to crawl until I could start to walk. And then we started it all over. I was working 50, 60 hours a week, which I don't even think legally you can do now. But I literally lived with him, ate with his family, and went to work with him every day. I thought 13, dear Lord, this is manhood. Holy God, what what I want yes, this sir. For. But I can't think of that summer and turning into that. And of course, from 13 to 14, you really start to grow and develop muscles. So I wouldn't trade that for my history for anything. And
Yes, sir.
It was wonderful, but it was brutally tough. I mean, it was, I literally wanted to quit karate and I wanted to come home from my uncle's. But, you know, of course I went home from karate. First time I got a rib cracked or my nose bled, and I'm like, you know, it's pretty rough stuff, to my mom and dad. You know, I don't know. They're like, no, it's good for you. You know, if it doesn't kill you, it's good for you. All that things heals. You know, stick with it, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, thank God for them, you know. And they had a way of putting that in a very, they never would say you're a wimp or you're giving up too easy. It was much more subtle. And man, the way that the tone, the look they would give you, it would like cut like a knife, man. It's like, well, there ain't no way in hell I'm quitting now. And, you know, locking that into my brain, it's probably why I'm still doing it now, because I took quit off the board.
Yes, sir.
And then, going through the martial arts and how tough it was back then, every single person that did quit, to me, became a badge of honor. You know, it was just like, there goes another one.
Yeah, really. That was almost like, you know, in a lot of the schools, they have stripes and different things to show progress. But the truth of the matter is, it was, you know, I'm still here and that guy's not here anymore. That was the way we literally measured our own progress, not in a cruel way, but just that was just the way it was. And you know, I will tell you this too. I think the schools were really strong. The classes were really strong. The practice, the etiquette was really strong, and there were very few people. But there was some value there. It really was. It's kind of refreshing that you talk
about.
That's kind
of why I also wanted a dojo. A real dojo too, because a lot of times we would rent rooms at the Eagles or the VFW or different places, and many times the instructors may have to work overtime, so all at once they weren't accessible, and you would have to work with an assistant instructor or another person, or classes would stop altogether for a short time. And I just hated that. But I had judo and I did everything I could get my hands on. So.
Yes, sir. Well, I remember, and it was very common, and I'm sure you probably heard this, but I can remember it was just the thing that people would tell brand new students would be, you know, look, you joined this dojo. most people don't make it. One in a thousand or fewer will ever become a black belt. But do you want, and to be honest with you, we were really exaggerating, because it was a much higher number, a much lower number than that.
Yeah.
So, but I remember when somebody said that, to me, that was the greatest challenge, the most exciting. One in a thousand? You mean I could be one in a thousand? Okay, it's going to be me. All right. And not that wasn't a discouragement. That was an encouragement. This is valuable. This is something very few people have. This is going to put you in a group of people that you can kind of prove to yourself that you can accomplish goals. And,
yeah.
And I think now there's definitely been a transition as a teacher, and I've been able to help a tremendous number of people that I wasn't able to help in the old days.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for that. There truly is. So tell me, how did you make the transition from student to beginning to be a teacher and sharing your knowledge? And
well,
of course, I know that you're an excellent teacher and things are different today. So tell us a little bit about how that.
Well, happened. Back then, martial arts typically was very competitive, and I was a fighter more than the kata type person, though I did katas. Judo was obviously competitive. And later on, I even trained with the Olympic, the guys that went to the Olympics for Taekwondo, had a military thing. So competition was a big part of my teens and 20s. And it was ferocious competition. I mean, when I first started in the 70s, mm-hmm. Many times there was no, hand protection or head protection, and it was a gymnasium floor. And then judo, you would have tough tatami mats, but they would be trying to put you through the floor. As I evolved, you know, I went to my first competition thinking I was going to, you know, win everything and be the next greatest, Bruce Lee or something. And that's kind of where I found out martial arts really is more of a mental, if I could beat the person mentally with my technical skills, but the mental strength, and that's how you win the competitions. It's not your kick, it's not your punch. You could be the greatest technical fighter, but if you were mentally weak or couldn't think fast on your feet, you were doomed. I don't know if you shared the same experience, but I started recruiting people that would be good training partners for me. And I would train them to be competitive partners that we would practice with all the time. So I guess that's my first level of teaching. And then many of those guys ended up becoming winning state and national championships as well. And we really came up with there's no excuse not to go to class. There's no excuse not to practice. You know, if you didn't show up and everyone else showed up, oh man, God help you the next day, because we were going to give you every kind of harassment because you didn't show up.
Yeah.
Because we knew how important it was. And it was that, you know, we trained fun many times outside or on dirt floors. For our practice, but our practice was to win, and we were having a great time at it. And you got phenomenal skills through all that just fighting and throwing each other. But I really didn't. I had to be talked into the dojo. I didn't want a dojo like I had been raised in, where it was kind of in a basement in the upstairs tile floors. Ohio Wesleyan wasn't bad, but it was a room in a basement in the very back that had an old nasty wrestling mat. And I wanted a nice place. I wanted a consistent place. I wanted a place where people would be there on a regular basis. And so I was kicking and dragging. I went into the military through my 20s. For Army infantry, and I did a lot of martial arts related to military stuff, and I would find a lot of black belts through that as well. But I had some guys come to me and let's do a dojo. And the original idea was kind of, I kick in a few hundred, they kick in a few hundred, and then we rent a little place, and then we only bring people in that we really, really want in there. And and I still think that's a pretty cool idea, but I was kind of like, we can't leave the head instructor out. I just don't see that working, and I don't want to sever my ties to the organization. I still like the lineage and it going back and understanding your roots. Now, I fight like me, but I want to be able to teach a consistent system. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So the next person, the next person may be twice as good as me or you. But if they don't have a consistent system, if they just learn what I do or what you do, it's very tough. So all the systems we're tied to now go straight back to Kano, straight back to Matsumura, straight back to Helio Gracie.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So it seems to me, and I just would just jump in here really quick, and sir, and just tell you that it seems to me, because you were talking about the tournaments and what happened in those days, and back in those days, what a lot of people don't understand, there's only a few karate organizations. Right. There's only a few. This was before the AKA, the PKC, the PKA, every letter of the alphabet, and there was only a couple. And so, we did a lot of the stuff that was through the United States Karate Association, which was started by Mr. Trias, but everybody, that was Bill Wallace was in an organization, Glenn Keeney was in it, Joe Lewis, all those guys were, and so there was this national body. So there'd be a tournament, that tournament's in Texas, but it's a USK, national point tournament. You'd go to Texas, and in those days we didn't fly very much, I can tell you, but you'd get in a vehicle, drive to Louisiana, and show up at a gym and compete, or go to Chicago.
They were rough too. And what were very rough.
They were.
You didn't roll on the ground. And what was everything else?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, what was great about it, though, was, we had, just as you did, a really good, strong, traditional karate school. These are the basics. These are the structure, right? This is, you don't look at other styles. It's like I was telling my students, it was one life, one style. And it had a lineage and it had a perfection to it. Yet you'd go to Chicago and you'd have guys with the most crazy jump spinning, flamboyant, and you'd get in a ring with them, and you'd fight them, and you didn't respect them from the standpoint of the style that they were doing or what their etiquette was, but somehow you'd get out of that ring and you'd be friends with them, And I really love the idea of having a real testing ground for karate, but then going back to that.
And it was a way of life. I can't, for a certain duration of time. I was at a tournament, I think, damn near every weekend or every other weekend. I mean, it was a very serious undertaking. And for me to become a serious competitor, I remember the first competition I went to. There were 50 men in that division, 50 men at a beginner. And it was 50, at least 50 in every division. So I never, ever, ever thought I was going to win a whole division of all these people. I'm like, well, how in the heck and how long is this going to take? And literally for me to get the real hang, the mental, the kind of manipulation in tournaments, the ability to go all day fighting on, chips and a hot dog. Right. Oh man, it took at least 4 or 5 years to really be incredibly competitive. Now I won different things before that, but to be the guy they're coming there to be, it took a long time, which I'm sure did for you. I mean, how long it took you to evolve?
well, you know, when you're a kid, you start out thinking things the way a kid thinks of things, and then at some point you're not a kid anymore, and everything changes. So, but absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about how you're viewing, let's kind of go broad term, martial arts in the world today. So what would be one or two events or one or two things of influence that in your mind really has changed the way that people view martial arts? You know, we all do have a tendency to get nostalgic, and that's fair because there are some stuff in the past that we absolutely loved, but you know, wasn't all that good either. You know, it's kind of like we all have a tendency to scream out bad things and remember the good.
Evolving. You know, there, when I first started, there were very few so-called professional martial arts schools. Tracy's Kempo Karate was one around Ohio. JT Will was the head guy, and of course he got arrested later on, which brought that one down. And then there was some Taekwondo, but I was only exposed to more the old school karate. And then when we opened up a full-time school, you had already had one. We opened the first one in 1992. And that was the first we had kids in any class ever. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of problems, and it caused a lot of friction within the partnership, because some people wanted to, you know, just teach the kids the same things you're teaching an adult, just take out the dangerous stuff. And that doesn't always work so well. There's a lot of, like, the forms and things that they're just hard for kids to do. And you couldn't teach old school without running everybody off. We were the first professional mm-hmm. school in Delaware, Ohio. So I think we signed up 60 people the first month we opened, because Ninja Turtles were a big craze, Power Rangers. I didn't really enjoy it. Neither did me, the other guy that was the main. We were the two main teachers at that school, and it was a lot like herding cats. And it was very difficult mm-hmm. for the kids to learn what we were trying to teach. And we were, because we were raised that way, like, you should walk in as a martial artist. You should walk in tough. You should walk in ready. And I think I kind of had to learn to, you know, I have to take some time to teach them how to be martial artists, to develop the self-discipline, the self-control, the personal practice, the showing up. So we had a lot of yes. learning through the School of Hard Knocks, through the first school that we had. And then a few years later, I kind of, the other guys wanted to be done. They just didn't like the experience overall. So I opened on my own, and I purposely kept the school to a much more manageable, where I know everybody. It's a different experience. I want them to be martial artists.
Yeah.
So we still start things like sparring or rolling early, but it's not free sparring. It's not free rolling. It's more, everything to me now is a developmental thing. It's not just beat the tar out of each other, which I think, like MMA, you know, it came around pretty close to that, the whole, Hoist Gracie and that thing. And you know, that I love the entertainment aspect of it, but that, you know, it's almost like human dog fighting kind of in a lot of ways. And so there's a lot of good and bads within the martial arts, and I think right now there's probably about 18,000 or so martial arts schools across the country. They say millions of practitioners. I'm not sure that that's the case, but the problem is quality. To me, my best guess is probably only about 5%, and I think that's being very conservative, are truly high quality schools that are doing a good quality martial art. They have a solid lineage to the past. They've evolved to the current. They're, you know, I just think it's very few. And like with the stuff going on now with the coronavirus, you're going to see a lot of schools go under. And unfortunately, they're going to get replaced by some knucklehead that's not qualified and doesn't know what he's doing.
Right.
Now, he might be a good martial artist in terms of technical, but it takes a long, long, long time to build a teacher. And, you know, if you look at teaching as a sensei as, oh, yeah, that's so cool, I want to do that, you have no idea what it is then, because the responsibilities are so big. You know, typically the pay is not, I mean, you could make it in other fields much more money with less energy. And it's not how flashy you are, it's how much you care about the students. You still have to be highly technical. Yes. And know what the heck you're talking about, but yes, you truly got to care about the art and the students and how it affects them.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, one of the things Sifu Brown said one time, I really admired it, is he said that, you know, the greatest thing about the martial arts field is it's totally unregulated. And that is also the worst thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I wouldn't
because there
regulated. There's no one I know that I would want to regulate it. And there's a lot of people I have a great deal of respect for, but even like, you know, where I do the same thing as Hanchi Alexander, I do the same thing as Pedro Sauer, but I'm not Pedro Sauer. I'm not Hanchi Alexander any more than they are me. You know, I'm a very well-rounded martial artist because of my jiu-jitsu and judo and weapons. You know, I'll always be able to do excellent kicks, but I'm never going to be the greatest kicker in the world. But that's not what I went in to do it. I wanted to be well-rounded. I don't want to be on TV or movies or... I don't look for a stage or a spotlight. So in martial arts, there's very, very different characters. You know, and some, I've known a lot of instructors just, and I'm not saying this mean, but they're very, very insecure. And, you know, they want that ego fed from their students. And that's not really the role of the instructor. You know, we all should have a healthy ego of some sort, but and some of that may be my military background too. You know, you're not just trying to break the guy down or make him do push-ups for sport. You know, you want these guys to be trained to survive combat, and being the platoon sergeant or the drill sergeant, you know what it takes to get them ready so they don't quit, so they don't curl up in a ball and, you know, and cry and hope it's over soon, you know. And I think good sensei do that way too, you know.
Well, and you know, I know also, like, you know, we've got to spend some good quality time with Sifu Brown and with others and with you. And one of the things for people listening to this, that, you know, if you've never visited Sensei Reed Miller's school, there's a saying in Zen, it says, how you do one thing is how you do everything. And he runs one of the most beautiful, clean, well-organized facilities you'll see anywhere in the country. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And but the point is that people like Sensei have come to this point where they realize it's not just physical, because we've seen it. We've seen that. We see people come into martial arts with low self-esteem. And of course, the advertisement is this will lift your self-esteem. Well, it will, but there also has to be internal work that's being done too, because otherwise what you do is you have a person that has low self-esteem that also can fight. And that's not what we're really into. So, of course, when you go into his dojo and everybody bows and their gis are so clean and squared away, and you see the etiquette, So what you've done, sir, is you've produced a product that is very appealing because you're teaching people this hardcore military background, how to fight. You get a lot of cops from the Columbus, Delaware area that have united with you. So they have this real bent. But at the same time, you know, you're producing some pretty darn good human beings. So can you talk a little bit about what you think about
Mark Warren, that's the point. The toughest challenge I see nowadays is, you know, we all live, but we don't live a lifestyle. And, you know, if you can decide on the life you want to live, the lifestyle, then the things that don't fit, get rid of them. You know, the things that are important, you start to put in every day. Now, whether that's meditation or reading or martial arts or all the above, saving money, eating right, whatever your lifestyle is. Now, you know, if you want to drink beer and have a, you know, a pizza every day, okay, you know, enjoy. You know, that's your lifestyle. And a lot of times nowadays I see that, you know, well, I'll give martial arts a try and see how I do. Well, it really doesn't work that way. It's kind of like when I learned to swim, they threw me in a river and I dog paddled, you know. Now that's not swimming really, but I'm not drowning either. You know, I had to learn to do it and I had to commit to doing it. And I think, you know, if you're going to do something like martial arts, I think anybody knows, you know, if you go into karate or jiu-jitsu or something like that, this is a big thing. This is a big undertaking. It's bigger than even going to college or things like that, from a real perspective. And so once you get that quitting out of your mind and you're committing, and then you show up, you know, that two times a week, and you show up to your practices, and you start to see confidence grow and the mental process going. One of my students that I work with, Dr. Beery, studies the martial arts. He's a trauma surgeon. He studies for neuroplasticity. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not quite sure what that is. And he's like, well, the neurosurgeon that sent me to you says that you're the best in the world at developing that. I'm like, I am personally? Like, no. Top martial artist. You know, people that are teaching you how to use your mind, use your body, tying it together. And you learn something, then you practice it. It develops that pathway. And if you do it for long enough, it starts to become a reflex. So if you're in a, you know, an unqualified, crappy place, you're learning the wrong thing. And that's going to become your reflex. Where if you get with a high quality teacher that's teaching high quality students, you're learning the proper thing. You're getting help from other students, you're getting guidance from the teacher, you're feeling it, you're doing it, you're reinforcing it. Despite yourself, you're going to start to become amazing at things that you didn't even realize. Your grades are going to go up, you're going to get promoted at your work, good things are going to start happening. And to me, that's the internal process. And, you know, the Okinawans that invented karate, Helio was 92 years old with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, the judo samurai guys, old. Well, why would these old guys design such a thing? Because they wanted their brains to stay good all the way up. They wanted their vital organs to stay good all the way up. They wanted to feel good all day. It's still like, almost like it haunts me, Helio. I want to feel good all the time. It's like, why would you eat like that? I interviewed him. Why would you eat like that? The body adjusts for the food you eat. It's like, because I want to feel good. I don't want indigestion. Yes. I don't want any problems. I want to be able to feel good all the time. And he trained, you know, I'll take a fight anytime. I don't train for a fight. I train every day for the self-defense. I train every day to eliminate stress. I train every day to make the systems and the processes that I live by, my way of life, And the martial arts are an extension to that, kind of the micro to the macro.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the themes in this conversation, without getting into the maybe the politics of it, or for lack of a better word, but, you know, is this notion that we are going to be protected by everything in today's society. And I was trying to talk to some of the kids on one of my online classes the other day, and it was really even hard to explain, because I could just almost feel them through the other side of the lens of the camera, not really getting what I was saying. So I had to kind of modify my story. But basically, I was telling them about a time when I had a parent drop me off at the dojo that picked me up late. And I came in, and, you know, the old tradition, if you're late, you know, sensei say 25 push-ups, you're late. And I stood on the edge of the mat, and I made that stupid childlike, of course, I was a child or kid at the time, and said, "Sir, my ride came late." And my teacher said, "The person that dropped you off is not enrolled in this dojo. You do 50 push-ups now." And I never made that mistake again. But the truth of the matter is, if you wanted to get to the dojo, you got to the dojo. If you walked to the dojo for 2 or 3 miles and it was raining, you got an umbrella or put a cardboard piece of foam over your head. This was the world that we lived in. And now here we are as a society today where everybody is protected from everything. And I think it really, I don't think you win in life by being protected from things. I think what you do, you win in life by having ingenuity and being creative and setting goals and getting out and making things happen. And that's just my little soapbox.
I'm in total agreement. When we were coming up, if you try to read a book or a magazine on the martial arts, it was very almost comic bookish. And, and I really look for teachers that were smart individuals and books. Thank God they've improved. And they talk about some of these things, a much deeper issue and understanding. I love Lessons in Mindfulness with Sifu Brown. I do that on a fairly regular basis, just go through all of them. A touch. And I have his CDs and stuff, so I listen to those occasionally as well. But and talk to him. But, people put this like this little, I'm a fighter, I'm a warrior, but they don't understand what that means. You know, that's like that military bearing. It's, it's getting up even if you don't feel like it's facing any challenge that hits. You know, they like to think about it from a TV version. You know, I'm a fighter. Oh, who are you going to fight? What are you going to hit? Who are you going to hit? I'm going to tell you know, the people. And I've had a lot of fights because I've done security and competitive and all that. But those are the easiest battles I've ever faced. Those are not my scariest battles. It's, someone I love that's sick, like this now where my dojo's closed because of a pandemic. It's easy to quit during those times, but that's when the fighter fights. It's when things really come.
Right.
And of course, I teach a lot of self-defense, so nobody thinks it's ever going to happen to them unless they've been attacked before, or unless the crime is, or that thing has come into their world. Then every single time it's like, God, I should have been more prepared. I had no idea. We all face that, and as teachers, we will even share with our students some of these things, and they may think, well, golly gee, why didn't he handle that? Why wasn't he better prepared for it? Well, we're never prepared for that sucker punch of life. It's what you deal with after you get hit with it.
Well, when you said that, people will say I'm a warrior without really knowing what that means, it just reminds me of a really quick story. So bunch of us used to stay on Saturday and work out really hard together, and it usually was sparring. We would really, really work hard, but it was all in good spirit. It was all strong, but it was just amazing to me, all the people that, I'm a warrior, I'm a this, I'm a that, and the other thing. And then that sun would come out from behind a cloud and shine, And that class would go down to the three or four people that would always be there no matter what. And then those other 8 or 10 students, man, they had a boat, they had other things that they were doing. I remember one day, I mean, great work. I was doing Koshiki where we were doing the Bogu armor we're just banging hard, right? And a bunch of us training covered in sweat, head to toe, no air conditioning, you know how that is. And then the door opens up. And one of the students comes in. And he said, "Where were you? You didn't work out with us today." He said, "I got this tattoo." "So what is it?" And he had a little kanji of warrior on his forearm. And everybody kind of smiled at each other because the Warriors didn't have time on a Saturday afternoon to go get training. Tattoos. The Warriors were on the mats. Yeah. So let's go ahead then and give a little teaser for next week. I'd like to do this in a two-part interview. And the thing what I'd really like to talk to you about next week is how people can amp up their training right now during this COVID time. And what are some things that people are doing in your dojo? What are you doing to amp up your training and staying on top of your game? And then also, we'd like to talk to you a little bit about personal goal setting tips and tools. So without giving anybody too much, but if you could just give us a really brief taste of a couple of the things that you're doing training-wise and what your students are doing that is kind of getting people through without giving them too much detail.
Well, again, I look at it from a lifestyle component, number one. So like training and conditioning, you know, I kind of look at your reflexes, your balance, your overall, the whole picture, raw strength, endurance strength, so on. So I will try to design workouts specifically for those things, but I want the martial arts to complement my life, and I want those things that I work on to complement the martial arts and so on. So as synergized as I can. But then, like reflexes, I'll try to work on any number of things. You know, it could be handball, it could be trap shooting. All those work on eye-hand coordination, triangulation. So I want all those components. And I like the human factor. So running, jumping, swimming, you know, life. If you're not busy living, you're probably busy dying. And I'm not a big fan of just, well, I'm trying to save time and, you know, I'm using a smart this and a smart that. And it's like, well, if you're so damn smart, you'd be rich, an athlete. You know, where typically most people, I think the average is you're losing 5-6 hours a day to technology, and we're less efficient than we used to be. You know, even though we've got things so wonderful. So training, I think the big thing is you control what you can control. It, you know, if you can't get to the dojo right now, then, you know, when the commercial comes on, when you're sitting on your butt, get up and do your kata. It takes a minute. Get up and hold your balance. Do some flexibility. There's so many things. You know, if you're walking upstairs, do 20 push-ups and then go up the stairs or whatever. And get outside. You know, and breathe the fresh air. And if, you know, if it nearly killed you, well, you probably need more outside. That's what doodad Governor Cuomo was saying. 60% of the people that caught this stuff up in New York stayed inside the house and did nothing.
Right.
Like, if that doesn't tell you, that's a death sentence, man.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I heard Dr. Ben Carson say it's real easy to understand. If you take a teaspoon of salt, put it in a glass of water, you get salty water. Take that same teaspoon and throw it into the ocean, you'll never even notice it went in there. but in any case, and I've always thought, and I've taught my students this for a long time, that you know, there's two kinds of people. They're the kind of people that are on the other side of the screen, and there are the other people that are watching the screen. And for me, I would like to live my life as the one that is on the other side. I want to be the one that's participating.
Well, it's the people, whether it's the dojo or your life, you know, as we do this 6-foot distancing, You know, me and you have a relationship that goes back, you know, decades at this point. And Seaford Brown, those are very precious to me. You know, I've lost several really good friends. Sonny Kim was one. And, you know, getting to know the people in the dojo, the people in your life, and really learn how to connect with people doesn't mean you got to be their buddy, buddy, best friends. But people are, they are what the world is. And, you know, connecting with people, even if you don't like them, you should try to find something good about them, you know. And I see a lot of this divisiveness, yeah. You know, Trump, you know, if it wasn't him, this would be great. If it was him, it would be wonderful. You know, that's ridiculous, you know. I don't trust any politicians, yeah. but... Yeah. Yeah. Some do some good things and some do some horrible things. And, you know, we need to get back to being Americans and respecting our Constitution and our liberties. And, you know, I shouldn't be worried about your business. I should be taking care of mine and respecting you as a human being, that you're a thriving citizen and a contributor to our community. And even if I didn't like your martial arts, you still have many wonderful students and are making a wonderful contribution to the martial arts in your way. I don't think it has to be complicated, you know. Respect your own life and lifestyle. And
I agree. Yeah. So, Sensei, I just want to let you know I have tremendous respect for you and what you're doing and your school. And could you tell everybody where they can get more information about you?
Yeah, the website is summitmartialartsacademy.com. And it's in Delaware, Ohio. So if you look up Delaware, Ohio martial arts, it's going to pop up. We're on Facebook, too, for Summit Martial Arts. So it's pretty easy to track us down because we've been around a long time. And and we do accept visitors and people that want to train for a period of time. So
yes, sir. I really appreciate you taking the time today, and I can't wait to visit more. And God bless you. God bless Delaware.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Very soon. Thank you so much, sir. Thanks for listening to Ohio Martial Arts Mind Power. Come back next week for part two of my interview with Sensei Reed Miller from Delaware, Ohio. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it.